8 years ago, Rod Blagojevich was sent to federal prison. Now, WBEZ Chicago is tackling the rise and fall of our state's 40th governor in a podcast called Public Official A. Here's Patty Blagojevich speaking with Dave McKinney.
And they couldn't even really tell me what it was about. Something to do with the Senate seat. That's all I knew. And then they took him out the back. They put him in handcuffs. And I was just like, oh, you have got to be kidding me.
Plus, Illinois House Speaker Mike Madigan is being sued by a political opponent who says the speaker put sham candidates on the primary ballot. We'll unpack this story with the Chicago Tribune's Ray Long. And the internet of today is massive, complicated, and, as researcher Victor Ball says, almost taken for granted.
So now think about these millions of components that are connected to one another, and you rely on them so much, you don't want them to fail ever. That's the problem.
Thanks to Microsoft for that audio. We'll speak with Victor Ball as he gets ready to speak at the U of I. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. To the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, Microsoft researcher Victor Ball has worked on some of the internet's biggest breakthroughs since the late 90s, and he's going to join us to talk about what's changed, what hasn't, and what to expect in the coming years. But first, Illinois politics has kind of a reputation for corruption, and it doesn't come from nowhere. In the last 50 years, we've had four governors go to prison, from everything for racketeering to bribery and bank fraud. And in recent years, there's one infamous governor who stands out.
Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, I want to thank the people of Illinois, not just for their trust in me, but more importantly, for their belief that in this great state, at this challenging time, we can build a better life.
That, of course, is former Governor Rod Blagojevich on Victory Night in 2002. Nearly 6 years later, Blagojevich would be impeached, removed, sent to federal prison on corruption charges. Today, WBEZ is tackling the story of his rise and fall in a new podcast called Public Official A. The first two episodes have been released. New ones are going to be released every Friday. You can find them on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get your podcasts, really, as well as WBEZ's website. In the meantime, Dave McKinney's actually here with me in person at our new Chicago space broadcast space. We're at the University of Illinois Illini Center in downtown Chicago. Hey, Dave, welcome back to the 21st.
Hey, Nyla, nice digs here.
I know, it's nice to have you in person. So of all of the people that you talked to for this podcast, and we're going to get to all of the characters, obviously, former governor Rod Blagojevich was the one person you wanted to talk to. You didn't end up having a chance to interview him. And can you explain how you think you were close to getting him, right?
Well, we were. And I mean, we had spent a significant amount of time with his wife, Patty Blagojevich, I think close to 6 hours during multiple visits to their house on the northwest side of Chicago. And toward the end of that, in late November, early December, we'd gotten to a point where, you know, we made the request of Mrs. Blagojevich to talk to her husband, who is in prison in Colorado. And she said she would ask him, and then got back to us and said, yeah, go ahead. And so we got permission from the prison to we got the wheels going with the prison to make this happen. And then at the last minute, Rod Blagojevich decided he wanted to talk to counsel, and we didn't have it happen. And what we came to understand was their belief back in December that they thought that they were on a list of you know, people who would potentially receive some sort of executive clemency from President Trump, and they didn't want to upset the apple cart and what have you. But you know, here we are 6 weeks, 8 weeks after that, and that still hasn't come. So it's anyone's guess what's going on in the president's mind.
And I want to come back to the idea of a presidential pardon for former Governor Blagojevich. But first, I want to just go back to the story all the way to the beginning, to even to his election. You covered this as a reporter when this happened, and I think people probably will know the name Blagojevich. If they follow Illinois politics, they'll know, okay, he was the guy who was trying to sell Barack Obama's seat. There were a lot of tapes. But before that, I wonder if you can even talk about how he ended up being governor of Illinois.
Well, I mean, he was a state legislator first in the mid-90s, and then he moved on to Congress and was kind of a backbencher in Congress because Republicans had the majority, and he was a Democrat, of course. And so he comes out of Congress and in 2002 makes this run for governor. And people initially didn't take him seriously. There were a bunch of candidates that were better known and more name recognition.
And a lot of people said his name was too hard, right?
Too hard, you know, too too much of that. And then suddenly he goes out and, on this fundraising binge with his father-in-law, who was a former Chicago alderman, Dick Mell. And they raise $1 million, which at that point in time, I mean, now it sounds like pennies, but at that point in time, it was a significant amount of money, and it put him on the map. And so he became this, you know, kind of juggernaut, fundraising juggernaut, who, you know, young, handsome, energetic, and wound up winning in 2002. And you know, he at that, what people forget about that election, you know, we think of Illinois now primarily as a Democratic state, but prior to 2002, Republicans held the governor's mansion for 26 years, dating back to the mid-1970s. And so it was really a big, big political event then. And Democrats weren't accustomed to having that amount of power, but they had it all.
And then you covered the fall. So that's sort of a little abbreviated version of the rise of Governor Blagojevich. Yeah. At what point when you were a reporter, did you guys start to hear – did you know what was coming?
Well, I mean, it all started with this, you know, at the time it was hard to understand kind of the significance of it. There's this obscure state board called the Illinois Health Facilities Planning Board. And it's where hospitals go to, you know, get their expansion projects approved. Nobody's ever heard of it. And anyway, this board wound up being stacked essentially with Blagojevich appointees, many of whom were donors. And there were a couple of people in particular, one on the board, and then one of his chief fundraisers, a guy named Tony Rezko, who were, you know, involved basically in shakedown efforts. And one in particular involved a Naperville hospital, Edward Hospital. And the CEO at that time had come in and presented her hospital's plans. There was a demand in the community for it. And it winds up failing unanimously. And then she gets this kind of, you know, she has this encounter with a financial guy and a contractor. And, you know, they were both saying, you know, look, we can get your problem here figured out. And she came to learn later that they had been put up to it by one of the corrupt board members winds up being this guy who, you know, like Rezko, who winds up, you know, they're fundraisers for Blagojevich. And so at that point, we didn't really understand the significance of that. The real kind of watershed moment on the scandal front was when Mel, the father-in-law of the governor at that point, gets upset at him. They have this big public airing of you know, some bad family karma. And Mel makes this public claim that appointments to state boards and commissions that the governor was making were basically being kind of parceled off to people who would donate $50,000 to his campaign fund. And it was shocking because Rod had come in as a reformer and Mr. Ethics and everything like that. And to hear that coming from somebody within the family circle was a jolt. And that is then what got the FBI really focused in on wrongdoing in the Blagojevich orbit.
And I wonder how much you covering this on a day-to-day basis 10 years ago, and even, I guess, before that, how much of that made you want to do this podcast now?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, journalistically, you know, these assignments come along, you know, 10 years later, 20 years later, 40 years later. Let's go back and revisit something. And more often than not, these things kind of become what you call in the newspaper industry a clip job, and they're kind of boring. This is different. And what makes it different is that we've wound up talking to a lot of people who, you know, either haven't spoken publicly very much about their experience in all of this, or people who are kind of at ground zero in the whole thing. And we spent an inordinate amount of time with, you know, Mrs. Blagojevich, for example, being one of them, 6 hours with her over multiple interviews. And you really kind of get past the talking points when you spend that much time with a person. And some of the other folks that we talked to, you know, were the ex-FBI agents that were, you know, not only involved in the arrest on December 8th of 2008, but they had been listening to his conversations and Mrs. Blagojevich conversations on the phone for months. And it was, you know, hearing their perspective on how it all worked and what this arrest was like and their perception of him was fascinating. And we wound up talking to another guy who was a close personal friend of him, who wound up, you know, in the end being kind of a, you know, described as a Judas in all of this, a guy who winds up being a government informant and turning on Blagojevich, his friend. And he became kind of a pivotal player in all of this too, not spoken publicly. So we bring together all of these voices from the past who have this perspective now of 10 years and really then the thing that gets this above that kind of clip chop thing is you have the president of the United States back in late May of last year raising the possibility that he might consider springing Blagojevich free from prison because he doesn't think that Blagojevich did anything other than just do a bunch of stupid talking.
I'm speaking with Dave McKinney from WBEZ, and we're talking about a new podcast, Public Official A, that he hosts. And let's play a little clip from the podcast. It's actually back, it takes us back to that day, that morning on in December of 2008, the day Rod Blagojevich was arrested. And this is his wife, Patty, describing what it was like when the FBI first called them in the early morning hours.
I hung up on him because I thought, like, this is a prank call. Call back. They're like, no, this is the FBI. Come down or we're going to break the door down.
So the two of you are in bed together when this rings?
We're in the bed together and, you know, our little daughter, Annie, had like come into our bed in the middle of the night like how kids sometimes do. So she was in bed with us too.
She was in between you.
Yeah. Yeah. So I came downstairs and they come rushing into the house. You know, where is he? Upstairs. They go rushing upstairs. And then I followed them. And then they were like, wanted to take him. I said, well, can at least he like put a suit on or get dressed? They're like, no, we got to go now. I'm like, what is this? You know, so, and they couldn't even really tell me what it was about. Something to do with the Senate seat. That's all I knew. It had something to do with the Senate seat. And then they took him out the back. They put him in handcuffs. And I was just like, oh, you have got to be kidding me. You're handcuffing him? And they took him out my backyard and into the police car and he was gone.
That's a clip from Public Official A, the new podcast from WBEZ. Host, reporter Dave McKinney is here in studio with me talking about it. Dave, so we hear her, as you said, you spent a lot of time with her on this, with Mrs. Blagojevich. She seems very candid in this. She was pretty open throughout the first two episodes with you. And I think it's very interesting in part because of her stance in terms of defending his innocence. And I wonder how you think she sees the case today with this perspective of 10 years?
Well, I mean, she's been quite active. I mean, all you have to do is tune in Fox News, and there's Patty Blagojevich. I think from, you know, in calendar year 2018, I think she was on six times, and she knows that that's Trump's favorite television channel, so she's using it to make a personal appeal to him. You know, she looks at all of the wrongdoing here that Rod was ultimately convicted and sentenced for as the result of, you know, what should be considered normal fundraising, normal political fundraising. And she also makes the point that they were not personally enriched by anything that he wound up being convicted from. And so those are the core elements of her argument. And you know, she then kind of gets sort of Trumpian and says that the, you know, accuses the you know, federal prosecutors and the FBI of overreach. And then you heard in that clip there about what that experience was like the morning, you know, where they get rousted from bed and Rod then is taken out in handcuffs and their world gets turned upside down. So, I mean, her arguments are essentially that. And what's most striking about spending time with her these days is that, you know, it's hard not to have a measure of empathy for what happened to this family. I mean, you know, sure, it's easy.
His family to his children.
Absolutely. And it's easy to say that, you know, Blagojevich deserves every day in prison that he got. But at the same time, you know, there are two daughters that were involved here and this family was really turned upside down. And that's part of her story
as well.
And
that's part of a question you posed to the FBI agents as well. You asked them about that.
I did. And that particular clip is from the former special agent in charge of Chicago. He was the lead supervisor, Robert Grant. And Grant made a very salient point. It's like, you know what? Families matter to everybody. And it doesn't matter, you know, if it's the former first family of Illinois or it's somebody else who's serving time in prison. That's one of the drawbacks of going to prison. You lose contact with your family. And Grant's point was, well, they should have been thinking about all of that when some of this wrongdoing was occurring. So, you know, but again, you know, you hear stories like the governor's eldest daughter, how, you know, after Trump made his initial statement that he might consider freeing him, you know, she got her hopes up and then reached a point where, you know, after months of seeing nothing happen, basically quit reading her father's emails from prison because they were too painful for her to read. I mean, anecdotes like that, you know, they're just all over the place. And we did our interview sitting in the library of the Blagojevich family home, and it's just filled, you know, wall to wall with these biographies of, like, you know, Churchill and Elizabeth and Lincoln and Reagan and all, you know, all these things that were part of his kind of thing. I mean, you remember he would just sort of throw these quotes out willy-nilly of, you know, of Lincoln and just recite them as if he knew many of them by heart, you know, but it was a fascinating environment to be kind of just going back and exploring all of this.
Mm. And then you mentioned President Trump, and I think that we have to just talk about that for a minute. You had a chance to speak with New York Times reporter Maggie Haberman. She was on the Air Force One that day when President Trump kind of mused out loud about possibly pardoning former Governor Blagojevich. How can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yeah, I mean, Maggie Haberman has kind of, you know, we always see her popping up on CNN, and she's on the White House beat and story after story about the Trump presidency. She's got her byline on it, and so she was the pool reporter that day when out of nowhere, Trump brings up pardons, and you know, he was talking about another individual. That was kind of the thing, but then out of the blue, he brings up Blagojevich. And as I said earlier,
he brought up
Blagojevich. And of course, the two of them have history together, or some history, because, you know, before his trial, Blagojevich was kind of on this media barnstorming tour to try to win public favor. And he went on Trump's Celebrity Apprentice show. And you know, he wound up being fired, but he got to know Trump a little bit there. And so Trump brings up Blagojevich's name, says he's, you know, he shouldn't have gone to prison. He just said a bunch of stupid things, and that he's not thinking about pardoning him, but maybe commuting his sentence. Rod was sentenced to 14 years in prison. He's halfway through that now. And so the Blagojevich family just went haywire. They're like, wow, this is a big development, because they had tried, you know, for years to get the Court of Appeals and the U.S. Supreme Court to undo the convictions, and it never worked. And now here's a new opening.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Dave McKinney, learn a little bit more about whether or not this commutation of a sentence will actually happen when it comes to former Governor Rod Blagojevich. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about a new podcast, Public Official A from WBEZ. That title refers to former Governor Rod Blagojevich after he was arrested on corruption charges. Rod Blagojevich went on a media blitz, as we were just talking about, which included President Trump's show, The Celebrity Apprentice.
And Governor, I have great respect for you. I have great respect for your tenacity, for the fact that you just don't give up. But Rod, you're fired.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much.
That's a clip from the new WBEZ podcast, Public Official A. Host reporter Dave McKinney is here with me from the Illini Center in downtown Chicago. So, of course, we were just hearing there that moment of the infamous "you're fired" line. But, Dave, that was also the beginning, as we were just talking about before the break, what may turn out to be a crucial relationship for the former governor now.
Well, yeah, completely. And Mrs. Blagojevich told us this anecdote, you know, during the taping of that show, the Blagojevich family was there, the two daughters, and they were in the elevator with Donald Trump and Ivanka Trump. And at one point, Trump starts talking to the Blagojevich children and says, "You've got a good father." And, you know, and so there's kind of like this thing going on, like, you know, who knows what that was all about. But at any rate, they do feel like there's a bit of a relationship there, you know, not a casual one, I guess you could say. And it's just fascinating to watch, because, you know, what we've seen happen is that, you know, Trump has basically said two things in 2018 about Blagojevich. One was what we just talked about, and then in December, after one of Patty's appearances on Fox, you know, he described,
which clearly he must have been watching.
He was watching and described it as must-see TV, and that it was emblematic of everything that's wrong in America, what the Blagojeviches went through. But yet here we are, nothing has happened. And so I think that's a point of, you know, people are just in the Blagojevich orbit. They're trying to figure out what in the world is happening here.
And so now, as you mentioned, he's 8 years into his sentence.
He's seven.
Seven years. Mm-hmm. All of his appeals have been exhausted.
Right.
So really, this is President Trump is really his only option for getting out of prison early.
That's right. That's right.
And I wonder what parallels you see, and certainly this is something Patty Blagojevich has talked a lot about, between the political climate today and when we think about President Trump and Rod Blagojevich back in 2008.
Well, I mean, many of the players are identical. I mean, Robert Mueller shows up in this Blagojevich story at one point where, you know, he's in town for another purpose, and it's while the government has been secretly recording Blagojevich, and Grant, whom I mentioned, you know, has Mueller into his office and said, "Hey, do you want to hear kind of what we've been doing here?" Because, you know, Mueller was aware of it, and he thought, you know, Chicago's got corruption. It's like shooting fish in a barrel here. And Grant is like, "No, it's not. It's hard to do, but this is what we've been doing." And so he plays some of these profanity-laced recordings of Rod and Patty,
which now you can play on a podcast.
You can play on a podcast.
All of that.
I mean, although on one of our episodes, we did put a parental warning at the front, which felt kind of funny. But then Mueller, you know, he listens to this, and he's just, you know, Grant is amazing the way he describes it. He just says, you know, Mueller shakes his head, and he's like, "Only in Chicago. Only in Chicago." And, you know, and I mean, that's an anecdote that has, you know, circulated a little bit, but it's so interesting hearing these folks, you know, tell it in their own voices. And Patrick Fitzgerald is representing James Comey, who is another thorn in the president's side. And, you know, just recently Roger Stone being arrested, when that happened, I mean, it kind of gave me, you know, there were parallels. Patty would tell you there were parallels. And
that's certainly the case that she's making now,
sure,
on Fox, that,
sure,
the president is being unfairly targeted just like her husband was. And, of course, that's a direct appeal to President Trump.
Absolutely. And the real key is whether President Trump is really listening, and whether he's looking at this from some principled, you know, position, or it's just like, is he trying to sit on this and figure out a way to gig Mueller in some way? And it's, again, it's just the most curious aspect of all this is why he would bring it up and then just sort of sit on it for months and not do anything.
So the podcast is not finished, and obviously the story is not finished here as well, because we really don't know how this is going to play out over the next couple of weeks, maybe even for the rest of the year.
Yeah, it's true. And, you know, one of the episode that we'll hit, I guess, in a couple of weeks, we re-examine the tapes. I mean, people who have followed this story are familiar with those tapes. But, you know, you get a very different impression after sitting with Mrs. Blagojevich for 6 hours and you develop this empathy. Then you sit back and you listen to the tapes, and it's like it's a very different experience. I mean, they clearly, he in particular, Blagojevich, was, you know, looking at this, how can I leverage this Senate seat into something personal for him, or you know, something that would be a gain for him politically, personally, you know, it's something that would improve their lives. And it's fascinating hearing Mrs. Blagojevich defend what he was saying in those tapes, hearing the agents who were listening to the tapes characterize what they were hearing, you know. And so it's just that's sort of the beauty of this look back. You hear these voices of people that not a lot of folks have heard before.
That's Dave McKinney. You can get Public Official A wherever you get your podcasts. And there are two episodes out already, right, Dave?
Two, right.
And new episodes are being released on Fridays?
Yeah, Fridays through early March.
All right. So if you want to learn more about, delve deeper into this particular chapter of Illinois history and how it relates to the present, check out Public Official A. Dave, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Nala, thanks for having me.
To the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking politics on the 21st right now. We wanted to switch gears here and talk about House Speaker Mike Madigan. He's been involved in Illinois politics for half a century. He's also led Illinois' Democratic Party for decades, and throughout all of his many years as one of, if not the most powerful politicians in the state, Speaker Madigan has survived nearly every political challenge that has come his way. Last fall, though, the speaker sat down for nearly 5 hours to give a sworn deposition. By his account, the first time that's happened. He's been sued by Jason Gonzalez, who ran against him in a primary race and says Speaker Madigan put phony candidates on the ballot. We know about the deposition because the Chicago Tribune has a copy of it. Longtime investigative reporter Ray Long is with us now at the Illini Center. Hi, Ray. Welcome back to the 21st. So, Ray, I wanted to just start with Speaker Madigan and himself. He's been around for a long time. Anyone paying attention to the most recent election knows that Governor Rauner spent a lot of time going after him. This idea that you should never bet against a speaker obviously has been ingrained in the State House for a while. Where does that come from?
Well, he knows how to win, and he usually does when he lines up his deep thought, ability to...
Ray, I'm sorry. Can I stop you for a second there? It sounds like we're, seems like we're having a little audio problems
let's
there.
Just switch there microphones here. So what I was just saying is that he usually wins. When he figures out where he wants to go, he usually can line up the people he needs to line up, and he usually can leverage all the power he needs to leverage into a victory.
And so when we think about over the decades, what kind of political scandals, have there been political scandals attached to Speaker Madigan over the years?
Sure, there have been. He has. He was under federal investigation. He and his political operatives were under federal investigation, along with the other legislative caucuses, the four legislative caucuses in the House and Senate, were investigated for whether or not there were workers, rank-and-file workers, getting paid government salaries for doing political work. The chief of staff of the House Republicans, Mike Tristano, eventually went to prison for that, but none of Speaker Madigan's people did. There was also a federal investigation, a grand jury investigation into Mike Madigan looking at a contract for union workers over at Eastern Illinois University and his talk to the president of Eastern. She felt that he was trying to pressure her, allegedly pressure her, to improve the union contract if she expected to get her full money that she wanted for Eastern. Nothing came out of that one either. There have been a variety of others, like one time a lawmaker left and ended up with a contract to do legal work for the House Democrats. He never did any work, and he ended up reimbursing. And there were allegations by Republicans of ghost payrolling, but the speaker was cleared of that too.
So I wonder if we can focus on this. This is actually a lawsuit.
Right.
So this is a lawsuit that the speaker gave a deposition in, and it's a federal civil lawsuit filed by a gentleman named Jason Gonzalez, who
right.
ran against Speaker Madigan in a primary and says that Speaker Madigan conspired to put a sham candidates, phony candidates on the ballot. So what makes Jason Gonzalez believe that the speaker did this?
Well, there's been suspicions over the years that he's done that before, but the belief by Gonzalez is that these two other candidates didn't campaign, they didn't raise money, and in their depositions, they claimed they didn't even know the people who went out and collected signatures for them, and in some cases, they didn't even know how their petitions got filed. So there are questions made by Gonzalez, raised by Gonzalez, rather. And in the other depositions, one of the lieutenants of Madigan, Kevin Quinn, said that he had called out to another political figure to see if one of these folks who ended up running would be willing to run on the same district slate or on the same district in the same district race. So there were other connections related to the other person who is an alleged sham candidate too.
And it seems a bit counterintuitive why someone, if they're running a race, would want to have more candidates on the ballot, because I think to the an initial impression of someone who's just paying attention for the first time, they would think, well, that means there's more competition.
Right. Although that's also something that would mean that there are more opponents to split the opposition vote. And that's the
and if you're the incumbent.
If you're the incumbent, you've got more name ID, and theoretically it's easier for you to pile up some votes. But if you've got competition, you want to split that up as much as you can. Madigan, in his own deposition, said that it's better for him when there are more candidates. Now, he was pressed on whether that meant more Hispanic candidates, because the two alleged sham candidates and Gonzalez all had Hispanic-sounding names. But Madigan said, no, not Hispanic, but candidates overall.
I wonder, I'm speaking with Ray Long, investigative reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Ray, how significant is it that Speaker Madigan gave a deposition about this last fall?
Yeah, it's just unusual. The guy is 76 years old. He's been around politics forever in Illinois. He's got a half a century in politics, plus actually more than that, because he used to follow his dad around, who was a ward honcho years before he got involved himself. And he has been at the center of everything in Illinois politics for a half a century, and yet this is the first time, according to his deposition, that he's ever had to sit for one.
And do we know more about what the speaker has said? Obviously, he's denying, I'm assuming he's saying that this, and you just said this as well, that he's saying he thinks this lawsuit is baseless.
Right, right. And he also said that he believed that Gonzalez, the person who brought the lawsuit, is backed by Republican Governor Bruce Rauner, who was Madigan's nemesis for years. And so there were many folks who backed Rauner who also threw money toward Gonzalez. So
he's arguing this is really not about, it's really about political payback on behalf of Governor Rauner,
right,
as opposed to what he's doing.
Right. He called it a Republican invasion of the district.
I want to ask you about another case. The FBI secretly recorded Speaker Madigan. This was because of Chicago Alderman Ed Burke. I wonder how Speaker Madigan has responded to the fact that we're hearing now from lots of people in the Illinois establishment, mostly in Chicago, who were recorded during all of this FBI investigation into Alderman Burke.
Right. And situation was that Madigan was recorded by an associate of a developer who was looking into building a hotel in Chinatown here. And Madigan was recorded giving his pitch for the property tax business. The alderman who brought the developer in was a guy who caught Burke on tape himself. And so there's a lot of questions as to why Madigan was being recorded in the first place, but the recording, the records of the recording, according to the Sun-Times, which has seen this and no one else has actually shown no wrongdoing by the speaker.
Right. In fact, the speaker said in a statement he's happy to have anybody record his conversations because he doesn't have anything. He's happy to show everybody what he's doing because he doesn't have anything. He wasn't doing anything wrong. Ray, can I just ask you one last question? We just have about a minute left, but you mentioned earlier Kevin Quinn. That's a former longtime Madigan aide who was fired after being accused of repeated sexual harassment of a former campaign staffer. As we were talking about this deposition, that incident, you've covered Speaker Madigan for a lot of your career as a veteran journalist. I wonder how the past 18 months feels rockier than normal for Speaker Madigan?
I do. I do. In fact, we broke the story about Kevin Quinn and the woman who accused him of the really sexual harassment. Her name was Elena Hampton. And that really started a furious search for Me Too problems in Springfield. And Madigan has had to battle that. He's taken steps to try to right the ship. And he's still strong. He came back with the greatest majority he's ever had. But it has been a rocky road.
That's Ray Long with the Chicago Tribune. We'll tweet out Ray's stories about this if you're interested in learning more. Ray, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Good to be here.
Thanks for tuning in to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. 20 years feels like an eternity in the life of the internet. Back then, a Microsoft researcher named Victor Ball was working on something most of us take for granted now, the first Wi-Fi hotspot in a public place at a mall near Seattle. Well, since those days, the internet has changed in so many different ways, and we rely on it, I feel like, almost unconsciously, even as the systems behind it get more and more complicated. Victor has continued throughout this time to work on understanding and improving these systems. He's at the University of Illinois today, where he's a keynote speaker at a research conference for U of I students. He's a distinguished scientist, director of Microsoft's Mobile Networking and Research Group, and with us in our studios on the Urbana campus. Hi, Victor. Welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Nyla. Thank you for having me here. Thanks.
So, Victor, you work on a lot of different things. We're going to get to some of them in a minute, but I first just wanted to start by asking what the state of the internet was like when you first got your start in this field.
The internet was there, but not known to many people except for those in academia and perhaps large corporations. It wasn't pervasive as in known to the masses and people in general. So, it was still something we use for collaborating on projects and, you know, building new tech and that sort of thing, but nothing.
And I wonder what your thoughts were back in 1999 about why you wanted to install a public Wi-Fi hotspot.
Well, so there was the standard called IEEE 802.11, and this was built, actually dates back before that. It was this Wi-Fi, which we know as Wi-Fi or wireless LAN, was built for for caching. So what I mean by that, there was a company called NCR or National Cache Register, and they built it for cashiers. And so this was then picked up by Lucent, and they then started to think of more use for it. And I was using it in my lab as I was getting my doctoral degree. And so when I joined Microsoft, it became very clear to me that, you know, wireless was going to be the thing of the future. And so the first thing I did was install the whole thing in our building, Building 31 at the time. And I remember writing a memo to all the researchers there that this was the future, so get with the program. And in fact, Bill Gates loved it, and he then looked at it, and then I pitched this to him for the entire campus, and so he took a decision that he was going to install Wi-Fi in or wireless LANs at the time in the entire Microsoft campus. And so when that happened, a lot of other companies started to jump on it too, and so I think, well, this is interesting. And so as I was looking at the enterprise, it also struck me that most of the time we were spending indoors rather than outdoors. And so, I thought, why, if I can do this in enterprise, I can probably do it in public areas as well. So then I approached a Crossroads shopping center and told them that, hey, do you want to be the mall of the future and a shopping center of the future? And they were really excited about it, and they let me come in there and install this for everybody else. So.
And so back then, I guess I imagine people would have been accessing it via their computers?
Correct. You didn't have Wi-Fi integrated into their laptops. You had to actually buy a separate card, and it cost about $300 at the time. And you would buy it and plug it into your laptop and then use it that way.
So now, of course, let's fast forward to the world that we live in now, where we I think are frustrated if Wi-Fi isn't in a public place, because I think a lot of us just assume and come to expect that it's going to be everywhere. But I wanted to ask you about one issue you're involved with, and that's expanding internet access to places that may have a harder time with this. And I'm thinking particularly of rural areas. And we hear lots of politicians who talk about how important it is to provide broadband access for rural areas. But I wonder what you see as the biggest technological barriers to this issue as we're thinking about our rural parts of the country.
Yeah, this is a sort of a question that has weighed on me for a very, very long time. The thing is that, you know, when you think about telcos and the people who bring us cellular networks and things of that nature, they will go where there's money. So in rural area where, you know, people are spread wide and there's not that much density of people, the cost of providing cellular coverage or broadband access is very large. And so you don't see them being motivated enough to provide that coverage. So one of the things I realized many, many years, almost two decades ago, was that we need to bring the cost down. And so the way to bring the cost down was to try to build a network on unlicensed spectrum. So when you talk about cellular networks, this is licensed spectrum that these companies have bought for billions of dollars. And so now they have to get the cost back by charging their customers. But if you build it on unlicensed spectrum, this is a spectrum that is available, provided by the government for free. And anybody can build a network on it. So then I went on this campaign to try to build such networks. And so I use Wi-Fi, which works on unlicensed spectrum, and I built something called mesh networks, which was a multi-hop network, which would so that you didn't have to bring fiber drops or to everybody's house. You could actually just have packets go from one Wi-Fi device to another device to another device till it hits the internet. I also lobbied the government on what is now known as white spaces. This was TV spectrum that became available, and I sort of lobbied hard along.
Oh, to use that space instead.
Yeah, yeah. So then try to get them to use that unlicensed spectrum for rural coverage as well. So that's sort of, I mean, this is an ongoing thing. And, you know, Microsoft, for example, now has a program called Airband, where they have promised to provide 2 million users in rural areas broadband coverage in the next couple of years. So, yeah, we've been at it for a while, and we are doing it, and I think this is very necessary to bridge this information divide.
And so do you think that, it sounds like you're saying you think that technology does exist now, it's just that it's still too expensive?
Well, the technology exists, correct. It is inexpensive, but somebody has to go and do it, right? And so the question is, whoever does it will like to get some money back when they spend money on the process. So companies like Microsoft, which can afford to do it, are actually stepping forward and doing it and trying to get local people to step up and basically use the same tech and replicate it and provide more coverage of that nature, so more organically.
My guest is Victor Ball, who's the director of Microsoft's Mobile Networking and Research Group. And Victor, I mean, as we're talking about this, it really strikes me that, and we've heard conversations about this, that we should think of the internet and access to web technology as a public, as whether or not this should be considered like a public utility, like the way people regulate water or the way phones were set up. And do you feel like we're still not at a point of understanding that the internet should be treated like a public utility company?
Well, I think there is, in the U.S. at least, I think people are starting to understand that. In fact, I don't think most people, when they go to a hotel, they want to make sure that they have Wi-Fi coverage and connected and things of that nature. But the reality is that, you know, more than 4 billion people around the world don't actually have any internet access. And you're right, like, in the sense it has to be treated like utility, because information is very, very necessary to make good decisions. And people who do not have access to good information make bad decisions, and that impacts everyone. So I think there is no question that we need to treat this as a utility. We need to make sure that it's actually a basic human right to be able to connect it to everyone else, and all companies, including us, and we need to really work hard to make sure that everybody has equal access to information.
Do you think that we can learn in this country from ways other countries are trying to provide internet access? Are there places we can learn from, particularly when we're thinking about rural areas?
Yes. The short answer is yes, because I think what happens is that here we have a thing where there are people who have great access and they don't quite understand what it means not to have access. And then there are people who do not have access at all. And so in other countries where they don't have great access, they have come up with interesting technologies and different technologies, which, for example, I mentioned mesh networking, right? And so they have done it, refined it, and made it work for themselves. And so I think there is something to be learned from that. And how did they do this at low cost? Perhaps we can actually do that as well. But having said that, I think the government has a lot of role to play here as well. Providing more unlicensed frequencies will allow more entrepreneur-like people to go and build out these networks. And providing funds to go in and provide connectivity will also help in the U.S. And I think they should do that.
My guest is Victor Ball, who's the director of Microsoft's Mobile Networking and Research Group, and he's on the University of Illinois campus today to speak to students, computer science students. Victor, I wanted to ask you about something, and I imagine this is something students at the University of Illinois are really interested in. It's this idea of edge computing, and I wonder if you can explain that to folks who've never heard the term before, what we mean. I think people have heard the term of the cloud and the fact that we're storing things in a cloud. How does edge computing relate to that?
Sure, I would be happy to. So let's assume that people now understand what cloud computing is. Effectively, cloud computing provides computing resources and storage, right? So you don't have to worry about buying your own computers. You don't have to worry about managing them, etc. You just sort of rent them out from the cloud and you use them. Now, so that's all good. It's been going on, and it's taken the world by the storm, and a lot of good things are happening there. But then you ask the question that, hey, what if I don't actually have a good network? I mean, we've been talking about that right now a few minutes ago. What if my network bandwidth is very expensive and I have to pay a lot of money? What if I have an application that requires low latency to the computes, 1 to 2 milliseconds? So in all these cases, the cloud sort of is not able to help. So then the question is, okay, so if we can't get to the cloud, can we bring the cloud to us? And that's kind of what edge computing is. Edge computing says, hey, let's bring some computing resources closer to where the data is.
Geographically, so actually physically, yeah, as opposed to virtually.
Correct.
Because that lag, actually that geographic lag is what causes a virtual lag, right? So when someone opens up a web page, if it takes a while to load, partially that may be because of sort of a geographic distance as well?
That is correct. I mean, you are limited by the speed of light. And of course, if there's, and some of these applications require very, very fast turnaround time. I mean, I'll give you an example of that. For example, if you're doing some vision analysis where you're taking videos and you want to do analytics on that and find out who is in the video or what objects are in the video, that has to be computed. Now, if it takes time to take that data into the cloud, compute there, bring it back, then the lag there is so much that the application can't actually work really well. Gaming is another example of that. So now if you bring the computers closely, as you mentioned, geographically closer to where the data is, then the time it takes to get to computing becomes very low. And so then you can now do all the computing and then offer all the answers. And that's edge computing. But now, so let me add more than that. So now you must have heard of Internet of Things or IoT. And so what is happening is there's a revolution happening in many, many industry sectors, not just in IT. So, for example, manufacturing has a thing called Industry 4.0. The idea there is that they want to infuse IT into their processes, manufacturing processes, for efficiency, for cost reductions, for higher productivity, and that sort of thing. And so then they want to have computing on-premise, so on their own factory floor. And you want the data to get to that and then do the analytics and then get back and do the control of that. And so edge computing is taken off on that aspect as well. So it's a pretty serious paradigm change in the way we've been thinking about cloud, and it's also in some sense a natural evolution of cloud computing.
Right. It sounds like a lot of interesting, as we see the internet continuing to evolve and access to that, how that changes. I appreciate you sharing your insights with us. That's Victor Ball, Director of Microsoft's Mobile Networking and Research Group. Victor, thanks for being with me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much for having me.
That does it for us today on the program. Coming up tomorrow, some of the first African Americans to ever serve in the Marines live right here in Illinois. Most of them are in their 90s, but they might be losing their local Veterans Center on Chicago's South Side. We're going to be learning more about that. Our website, 21stShow.org, is a great resource for you to find past shows, for you to get in touch with us, find our social media handles. We're produced by Libby Foster, Robin Lynn, and Alan Montesilio, who's our senior producer. Bobby McSwain is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Moore. Scott Cameron is our executive editor. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, broadcasting today from the Illini Center in downtown Chicago. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening. See you back here tomorrow.